equals burn. The propaganda's win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1-200, the Independent Politics and Media Podcast. We are midweek, Wednesday, the 3rd of April. We've been trying to cover the ongoing genocide in Gaza over the course of events there during the current events episodes every weekend, but it's time again to do something a little longer, ensure that we have a more nuanced conversation about it and with more expert people than our usual co-hosts. I'm joined first and foremost by Tamim Shaltoni again. Welcome back, Tamim.
Thank you for having me again today, Kyle. And it's great to have this conversation with the host and the guest tonight.
We've also got Dylan Asafo, second time guest on the podcast. Welcome, Dylan.
Good, Kyle. Nice to be here.
And we're third joined by Karen Kelly. You might remember we did probably one of our longest episodes a month or so back on the ICJ rulings with Karen. Welcome in, Karen.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So I don't even know where we start with what's been happening in Gaza since we last did a big update. I think the last time we were at a point where the civilian deaths were at 30,000. And since then, that number has barely changed because Israel has made it their goal to destroy all the infrastructure and institutions that were able to keep track of that. And that was 2 or 3 months ago. It's an utterly horrific state of affairs, probably the worst in my lifetime. And I'm not old, but I'm not young either. Day after day, there are new atrocities, just as people are responding to the latest atrocities from Israel, they enact another one. In the last 48 hours, there have been multiple of that sort. They have fully destroyed Al Sheba Hospital now. There is, I believe, zero health infrastructure left in Gaza at this point. They bombed with targeted drone strikes and killed 7 aid workers with the World Food Kitchen who were on an approved IDF humanitarian route. And the other, I guess, bigger one, because there's so many more than this. These are just the worst, is that Israel has started moving further outside its borders, bombing the Iranian embassy in Syria and effectively assassinating one of the Iranian military leaders there. Tamim, we are often seeing these large kind of news headline atrocities. It's absurd to me that we have like a scale of atrocity now to try and parse what is happening day to day in Gaza. But what have you been hearing from the region, from Gaza, in terms of the overall situation?
Yeah, I mean, it is exhausting, especially as you are attached or glued to the news, and it's just literally one atrocity to another, to another, to another. I was saying today, you know, they make one atrocity which distracts you from another atrocity that happened the day before, hours before, and that one itself, it distracted from an atrocity that happened before, and it goes on and on and on, and you don't have time to process the significance of each atrocity, you know, the magnitude of the crime, and it's just exhausting. Like in particular, for example, this attack on the WCK aid convoy. It's just one atrocity, but it's part of a theme. Israel is using starvation as a weapon, and we know this. And even Israel, they were clear about it. You know, since they started the attack, the assault, or the genocide, you know, the Gallant, that famous video, he came on record and he said, you know, we're implementing this siege on Gaza. No food, no fuel, nothing. So he was pretty clear, and that is the strategy Israel is implementing in Gaza. We all know this. Before this attack on the World Central Kitchen, There have been multiple attacks on civil committees or community groups that Gazans organize in order to coordinate the aid distribution, because Israel, you know, just said, "Oh no, well, we're Hamas. We're not gonna deal with them." So these civil committees decided to organize themselves, but then Israel attacked them again. Israel attacked people expecting aid multiple times. It attacked warehouses where food aid was stored. So all these atrocities, they are part of that, using starvation as weapon. And I think this is important because we often get attached with the details one event at a time, but we forget sometimes the big picture. So I think it's good to, while yes, we want to be across the details and the exact atrocities or massacres committed at a time, but we need to be focused on the strategy as well, and to put all these attacks as part of one pattern or one theme and understand the significance of that. I think there has been a report or multiple reports on the starvation as weapon. So that's a big crime in itself, and all these attacks, they fall underneath it. There's the attack on the second attack on Al-Shifa hospital, because there was one back, the first one back in November, and this Al-Shifa attack has been the central to Israel's assault on Gaza. Like, it's become like one of its key objectives, and it's just, it's weird when, like, this second attack, it's just, the justification is just doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, all of a sudden they said Hamas and Jihad, they reconvened and they have hundreds all of a sudden in a Shiva hospital. It just logistically, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why would they do that, especially after, you know, the previous attack on a Shiva hospital? And why hundreds in one place? Like, I don't know if you saw, if you see videos from the resistance, you can't find three resistance fighters next to each other because they know that's a risk and they will get assassinated. So it just, it doesn't make sense to consolidate or to bring hundreds of them in one place, and in a hospital, you know.
Well, weren't they basically in control of the compound for days and days as well, the IDF? So, I mean, it would be pretty hard for, I mean, we know from eyewitnesses what they were doing was murdering people, but their story is that they killed 400 Hamas militants. Where were the, how were they in the hospital for so long existing, you know, were they fighting corridor to corridor? It just doesn't make any sense, really, does it?
No, I mean, they released photos at some stage, like, oh, we're all these terrorists that we captured. And then within hours, people started looking at the photos and they found out there are a lot of duplicates. And, oh, this guy actually was killed weeks ago. And this guy, oh, he's at his home. And this guy just, he's not Hamas. And within hours, Israel came and said, oh, sorry, I mean, there has been administration error or something. And they said, oh, that was incorrect. So it just, you know, lies upon lies. And they know they're lying, and they know no one really cares, as far as, you know, the international community is concerned.
Could I just build on something that Tamim was saying, like, about the confusion that they caused by creating one atrocity after the other after the other? There's also a process, I think, of inoculation that goes on. So they do headline-grabbing things like the attack on WCK or the flower massacre. And then they fight tooth and nail to try and control the narrative. And they may concede a little bit and they may not. But in the meantime, they've set the bar to such a level that they can continue lower level attacks or less headline grabbing things that go on. And it becomes normalized, you know, and like you could go back decades, like to when they first started murdering UN observers, you know, which you would think would be kind of a red line for people, but it wasn't a red line. They established it as a norm that they could get away with, and thus they have controlled where UN observers can go. And, of course, this is the point of attacking the aid workers like this. They can prevent food aid from getting in without having to face further headlines. And they'll probably do a big mea culpa about these particular privileged aid workers who happen to be, you know, Westerners.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, right? It's about ensuring that these groups think it's too dangerous for their workers to be in Gaza. You know, WCK has already pulled out. There's likely to be other groups pulling out as well, because they know the IDF is just going to assassinate them. They're like, that you will be murdered. And this is what the IDF is saying. This is the intent of what they are doing here. I'm not even sure that we are at a point anymore where this is about controlling the narrative so much as about showing they can act with impunity, with the barest cover.
I think that is controlling the narrative from a certain perspective. I think that's how they want to control the narrative, is to demonstrate that they can act with impunity, and to show that people like Anthony Albanese, for example, are completely powerless to oppose them, to actually show that he is an obedient lapdog.
Yeah, despite one of the aid workers being an Australian citizen in the most recent example. And you've seen that as well with US representatives. They just parrot these lines. It's so absurd to watch. I think maybe the one difference this time around is that the atrocities are so great and there's so much information out there and so much coverage on the ground in Gaza that ordinary people are starting to understand how these relationships work in a way that I don't ever think I've seen in these communities before. Like, there have been a lot of people, we're just talking maybe in New Zealand, who have been part of Palestine solidarity movements and the like, but it's always been difficult to draw other people to that cause. And I think the baselines for that have markedly shifted now. The problem is that that's not enough. That's not enough because leadership there are no consequences to leadership yet, to the people who are making the decisions that allow this to continue. Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating, but I guess a small ray of hope there.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the weird thing is that, you know, we have a legal framework in which they are committing crimes, under the Genocide Convention, some of these people.
I can just add on to what you're both saying. I think it's really important to note that Israel knows that it doesn't have to give anything close to a compelling or robust justification or rationale. It's seen that the ICJ and its provisional measures are no constraint, and that the Security Council resolutions are no constraint, that if anything, that they're a tool for Western states to make it look like they care, that they're acting upon the atrocities that Israel is committing, but that Israel does not have to take any note or abide by anything that it's saying. So it's really important for us to think about the law as authorizing or permitting what's happening, maybe not explicitly in text, but very much in effect. And that should really inform the ways in which we organize, the ways in which we think about the ways that we appeal to our leaders, whether it's worth appealing to them, or whether we need to take further action, because this is what international law looks like in practice. It's doing what it's meant to do. And so if we know that what Israel is doing is completely not checked at all by the ICJ, then we need to move differently.
I'm gonna ask, absolutely.
Yeah, how? how do we do that? Because I think a lot of people out there are, people are showing up to the marches every weekend. Other people are writing letters in. You know, they're doing the things we're told to do in a Western liberal democracy, right? Write to your representatives, vote every 3 years. But I think people are really struggling to understand how to organize around this at this point, given that, you know, this is some of the best organizing that we've seen around a single issue in New Zealand, especially one that's kind of geopolitical in my memory. And yet the shifts, there have been shifts, but they've been so marginal.
I might sound negative here, but I think there's a reality that we need to face. Just like we say, I think I like to frame it, and many people might agree that Israel isn't breaking the international law. Actually, Israel is acting within the international law, because that is, you know, what the international law allows to happen, as Dylan, you said, in the same breath or along the same lines, I would say we reach to the limit of what can be done within Western countries. So I think we need to be realistic about the potential from Western countries. Western countries, they are part of the crime. They're not just complicit. You know, they are participating in the crime. They are giving Israel all the license that it needs. They're giving Israel money, arms, and just cover and everything. So we are banging into the wall, you know, with the protests in Western countries. And I don't think that there's anything more that can be achieved. It doesn't mean that we stop what we're doing. I think we just need to keep doing it, keep trying, because there's nothing better to do. But I think we reach to the limit of what our politicians are willing to do. I don't know what else can be done. And I think this is a nice segue to the protests in the region, in Jordan and Egypt. But I think maybe we can wait before jumping there and just maybe keep talking about this topic if anyone else has more thoughts about it.
I do have one thing to say about international law. I mean, particularly in light of the ICJ case taken by South Africa, is that it is a way in which people can corner them and corner the Zionists and their supporters and force them into revealing their hand more. And there was a late Christopher Black, a Canadian international law expert. He admitted fully that there's huge imperfections, but this is a formal system in which you can forensically attack the logic behind things. And so you can make arguments that force people to show that they disregard the law and take away that defense. And I think this is an important process that has to go through. And we, you know, and we also need to target the media and as individuals, as activists, to make sure that they cover it properly. Because, you know, if they do cover that properly, it has a massive impact on public opinion. This can constrain our leaders, get them to actually fear the repercussions, you know, of saying supporting Israel when the public sees what's actually happening.
I mean, I do agree with you, but the problem is, even if the ICJ, so yes, ICJ does have the processes to find the basically right conclusion, make the right judgment or order, but ICJ doesn't have enforcement powers, and it's going to be just another order sitting on the desks of the Security Council, and it gets vetoed again by the US. So I think even if we go that route and it works, you know, we will hit the same challenges that we have in the international law. So doesn't mean that we stop. I think we just carry on, but there are limits as well.
Yeah, I think probably in a similar vein to what you were saying, Karen, that reveal, it won't immediately save Gaza, right? Like whatever ruling the ICJ makes, you know, it comes out strongly against Israel. Yes, you're doing a genocide. That doesn't take away what's happened over the last 6 months. You know, it doesn't, like, it's already happened. The genocide has happened and is continuing to happen. But what it does do is it starts to give the lie to what we call, you know, the international order or rules-based international order, and reveal that for what it is as well. It starts to create instability around who has power in the system. And we start to see perhaps a realignment around how these things work. Because certainly at the moment, it is Israel and a select few Western countries, specifically the United States, I think, first and foremost, against the rest of the world. And I think everyone is seeing that. And it's, as I said, the results aren't immediate, but this is a defining moment in human history. And that's, I think, part of how we have to look at this as well. And I think what you're hoping to talk about next to me works within that framework as well, because we're seeing protests in some of the neighboring states at an extent that we haven't seen in a while either.
So I just need to be clear. First of all, there have been protests in Jordan since the beginning, every week, many major Jordanian cities. So it's not something new, but I think the intensity, the messaging and the media focus changed just recently. And I think that's a good indication. The protests since a week or something have been very intense, especially around the area of the Israeli embassy in Jordan, in Amman, which is really good. And we're seeing great messaging and really radical messaging in these protests, which sounds positive. Now, the protests in Jordan, they're a very special case. First of all, due to the demographic makeup in Jordan, half of the population in Jordan, they are originally from Palestine, Palestinian refugees who were expelled from Palestine and they went to Jordan, like my family, for example. So half of the people in Jordan, Jordanian, you know, have Jordanian passport, but they are originally from Palestine. So I think that is a unique aspect to the movement in Jordan. The other thing is the geographical proximity to Israel. Jordan sits next to occupied Palestine, and it has the longest borders with occupied Palestine, which makes it like a huge threat to Israel. It's in Israel's best interest to have security in Jordan, just to make sure, you know, there are no troubles or no threats coming from the borders, from the border of Jordan. So the protests in Jordan, if they grow stronger and they manage to get it closer to the borders, I think Israel will think twice about the next move. It will be forced to move a lot of its forces to the borders with Jordan, and it will be worried of the escalation that is happening there. Jordan situation, it's called Israel's nightmare. So Israel knows it sits and lives next to a dormant volcano, super volcano, and if it erupts in Jordan, it's gonna be a huge. It will have a huge consequences. So yeah, there's a big hope at the moment about the protests in Jordan. Some of the demands are around ending the normalization projects between Jordan and Israel. There's a lot of the trade going on in terms of the fuel, gas, water, and other stuff. So the demands are to end all these projects, all these trade agreements, and a lot of demands around the peace treaty itself, the peace treaty between Jordan and Israel, just to abolish it or do something about it. I think it's unlikely at this stage that anything will change about it, but it's good to see pressure from people around these areas. So yeah, I mean, it has been very refreshing to see these heightened or escalated protests in Jordan. I think this is something that could seriously change the course and just force Israel to make concessions.
It's really interesting to hear kind of a further breakdown of that from you, because we're hardly seeing any of this in Western media. You know, you have to be, I mean, Al Jazeera will cover this stuff. A couple of other places you'll be able to read about it, but we basically only get the IDF spokespeople talking about whatever atrocity they did recently, right? In mainstream media here and abroad to a large extent.
Yes, it's true. And speaking of Al Jazeera, which is another topic, so just a few days ago, Israel has been trying to ban Al Jazeera from reporting or from operating within Israel if they deemed, it's a generic legislation against any media platform that is deemed a threat to Israel's security. But I think everyone knows that it's about Al Jazeera, and Netanyahu himself, he said, yes, this is for Al Jazeera. So if they eventually ban Al Jazeera from operating within Israel, and when you say within Israel, it's you don't know exactly where, because Israel officially doesn't have borders and it operates just anywhere, everywhere across the world. But that means that ban or that legislation will be applicable within occupied Gaza, occupied West Bank. And the worry is the coverage, just the rare coverage that we're getting from Gaza will be under threat. Because it's mainly coming from Al Jazeera and many freelance journalists, but I think Al Jazeera, you know, it has a huge platform and it is making a big difference. And that is all as part of the attacks on media in general by Israel, because they are they have been already banning foreign press from going to Gaza, apart from coordinated tours within by the IDF itself. Like the IDF, they take them, okay, see this, we found Hamas here, we found Hamas there, and they just take them away. So there's no free press at all. And there's even censorship on Israeli media itself, while for us, the Israeli media is just part of that regime. But even that, it's getting censored by the IDF.
And even then, a lot of the Israeli media, you find out more from it than, say, local media here, which is absurd. Tamim, you also mentioned Egypt.
Yeah, so along with the protests in Jordan, there have been fresh protests in Egypt. I'm not across the details of that situation, but I'm seeing videos on Twitter and on social media. It looks like similar to what's happening in Jordan, other protests are popping up, or maybe more media coverage has been going on around protests in different areas in the Arab world, which many people, you know, just remember the Arab Spring and how it started. While here, the focus is not on the regimes themselves, but the focus is on Gaza. But I think it reminds everyone of that period.
Not sure whether to go into kind of deeper geopolitical stuff here or not, because just the other day, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, we had the strike in Syria on the Iranian embassy. Do you think there's a growing sense among countries in the region that Israel does want a wider war, that they are trying to escalate at this point? Because an action like that is beyond just, you know, bombing some civilians in Lebanon, right? Like they've done that for years and years and years. This is the kind of thing which is trying to bait Iran into taking action. It just seems like it's going to get totally out of control really, really soon, unless the US in particular puts their foot down.
Well, I just want to say that a demonstrative act that is very clearly meant to break the law, like that, to degrade the law, is a fascistic tactic. I mean, this is what fascists have done through history. And I wouldn't really, I mean, I don't know about the US putting their foot down about it, because it would have taken place with their full foreknowledge and approval, surely. So this is really the US as much acting through Israel as anything else. The reaction is to say we don't want a spread of violence, so immediately the onus is on Iran not to respond, which is quite interesting, because you have these provocations that come out of nowhere from one party over and over again, but it's always the other parties who are told not to respond. Whereas if you were really interested in ending with problems of proliferation, you would actually target the one that is initiating the aggression in the first place.
There was a really telling statement from John Kirby at the State Department, US State Department, today, or maybe late yesterday, where he basically said the State Department has a process to determine whether or not Israel has breached international humanitarian law. And this speaks to what you were saying earlier as well, Dylan. And up to now, we've found that they haven't, which is just ludicrous. Like, that's not a statement. Well, it's a statement of reality as far as what their considerations are, but it's not a factual statement about what's actually been occurring in Gaza. In regards to the way those norms are being degraded, Dylan, are you able to speak to it a little, in the way that I guess it's used as a tool in these imperial colonial frameworks to bring the other, just more generally, in line? Because this seems like they're just running straight from the playbook at the moment.
Well, sure. There have been long-standing critiques that I think are really resounding right now around international humanitarian law and how they were always meant to exclude people who the West see as inhumane or inhuman. And so we're really seeing that at the moment, the way that it can be misappropriated and co-opted, and also the low threshold for equality analysis. The fact that the US or any other state can say that they've conducted an analysis, can say that they've received advice, and that is enough. That is enough for many liberals within the West to say that they've discharged their duties, but also arguably it will be enough for the International Court of Justice, because these sorts of statements, they do muddy the waters of genocidal intent under the convention, because they're able to say, oh, we conducted analysis, we did due diligence, we are abiding by these norms. And if we have judges who are able to say that they're satisfied with that, that they've turned their mind and that's all that's required, that's a real indictment of international law and also international humanitarian law specifically. We need to mock and not take seriously these statements from the US or from any Western country about the way that they regard international law or rules-based order, because we're seeing, and an example that I'm going to bring from New Zealand, from the Official Information Act, you know, advice that was released around the lack of advice that New Zealand is acting on to make statements about international law, really shows us what is required of states, of Western states specifically, which is next to nothing.
We've seen a leak recently come out of the UK showing that they've had first a kind of heads up in November, then advice in January, then further advice saying that that Israel was breaking international law, and which, you know, means that according to their own law, they should stop supplying them arms. And I just want to, and you know, you're talking about like we've, you know, revealing that they've sought not to get advice in New Zealand. And I think the difference in the US is that what they've done, going back like to the era of Henry Kissinger, is actually to completely gut the civil service like that way and get everyone basically politicized and willing to say whatever it takes so they can, you know, cover their asses at all times and say we've got this, you know, we're all acting legally.
It's really something really sick about watching these people get up on the stage and say this stuff. It's like everyone knows they're lying and they know they're lying, but it somehow feels even worse than Iraq in terms of the lack of theater that is needed at this point, the lack of plausible deniability. They just put it all out there. They do not give a shit at this point. John Kirby was the one guy I mentioned, but the other one, Matt Miller, has been horrible to watch. It's just like the most sneering, smug approach to overwhelming atrocity and death. Yeah, it's something else.
Yeah, for sure. And what I'd add to that is that we have to remember that states like the US, like New Zealand, like Australia, they're illegitimate states. They're settler colonial states. So what we need to reckon with, and what we're seeing when we hear them espousing their nonsense and their abhorrent, justifications of genocide, is that that is typical of what a genocidal settler colonial state does. So we need to let that be radicalizing for us and naming the illegitimacy of the New Zealand, of the United States, of Australia, and championing indigenous sovereignty and self-determination in these states, because we know that if our constitution was different, if we honored Te Tiriti, that what we're seeing with the New Zealand state currently wouldn't happen. We're seeing, for example, role modeling from Te Pāti Māori about what a treaty-based Aotearoa would look like. We would have the Israeli ambassador being chased out, being expelled. We'd have the state of Palestine recognized and would have sanctions. So in terms of what we can do, and I totally agree exactly what Tamim says about we're seeing the limits of what can happen in the West. I'd add to that we're seeing the limits of what is possible within Western settler colonial states. So it's on us to go beyond protesting for a ceasefire and start protesting the status of these states, of these settler colonial states, and championing Indigenous resistance and sovereignty here. That's absolutely essential in terms of what we can do from where we're at.
Absolutely. And I think, what you're saying about the opportunity to radicalize around the stuff, right, is one of the really big moments of cognitive dissonance for people watching these states spokespeople get up, or watching, you know, UK people get up, is it's just like this horrible mirror to what we're seeing in our own countries as well. Like, wait, why are we siding with this? Why are we aping their language? I thought we were meant to have an independent foreign policy, right? Like, where is our voice within the structure? And I don't think I've seen it go so far beyond just Indigenous groups in the way it is with GASA right now, which is like an indictment of politics here. But it's also an opportunity, because our leadership and political frameworks are obviously set up just to support these other ones. And Kieran, you had a piece for us come out this week that described Israel in this way, right? And its necessity as part of the settler colonial apparatus to help dominate and destroy the Middle East.
Yeah, I think the domination part is more being able to project power into the oil-bearing regions rather than to colonize them directly, but to start a settler colonial project, which was as near as I can tell, anyway, the way I conclude it is that it was never meant to become a peaceful, stable state. It was always intended to be a site of violence, and that was its purpose.
And we can see that again and again throughout the history of the region, right?
Yeah, there was absolutely no reason that the British would suddenly decide that they would go with the maximalist Zionists who wanted a Jewish state, you know, when the demographics were totally against them all along, if, you know, apart from if they wanted something that would always be a source of conflict and a way of being able to destabilize neighboring regimes and control them.
Yeah, and what we are seeing from Israel is something even the liberal segments of in the Western countries should be really concerned about. It's important, I think, for center left and center right as well. Like, what we are seeing now is just making a mockery of the democracy that we have, and the legal systems and the free press. Clearly there's something wrong. There's something not working. So I think the people who should be concerned about this is much, much wider than what we have at the moment. And people slowly starting to realize that, this is really bad for us before it's bad for Palestinians. Just making a mockery of the entire system, if you like.
Yeah, and I think the other thing people need to keep in mind is that this is the model, right? What we're seeing happen in Gaza right now is the model for power projection of the next few decades. I think it's really hard to reach a different conclusion at this point. If the powers that be, predominantly being US hegemony, I have decided that this can happen. Where is that going to happen next? And we are also already seeing, I do want to shout out to other countries that are like in the midst of genocides as well at the moment, right? Like Sudan, for example, where it's similarly occurring. And it's about resource extraction. It's about destabilization as the great powers shift, and it's about control. And no one in the West is immune to having their state transformed in that way. Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, Australia is playing more of that role in our region. But New Zealand is kidding itself if it thinks it's not going to be dragged into some really horrific shit in the next 10 years. And I mean, more so than what we're already constantly being asked to support. This is, you can only balance the world on a framework like international rules-based order so long as people believe that it's doing something And I think people forget that other people actually do exist outside this picture we paint for ourselves in Western liberal democracies.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, obviously the international rules-based order is an ironic joke. It's, you know, this has always been a way of claiming the high moral ground while breaking the law left, right, and centre. But, you know, yeah, I think that Tamim, what he was saying and what you're saying, it kind of all goes back to what as well to what I was saying about fascism, and that it deliberately dismantles these regularities. So it moves beyond the hypocrisy, which is bad enough, into the blatant demonstrative action that shows that this stuff is no longer real, that it means nothing, that power is everything, naked power is everything. And that is actually even worse. Well, history suggests it's even worse. And one of the things I think that people should think about in terms of genocide, because it applies to us as well as people who are, like, you know, like, we might not be as inculpated as people in the US, but, you know, we are still really part of this. We are doing intelligence sharing that actually, we're doing other things that actually mean that we're participants in this genocide. One of the things about genocide is there's always a reflection from it. The people who commit genocide seek to create, to extinguish or diminish to almost nothing a certain group in order to control their own group as much as, you know, at the same time. So if you look at the Germans, their desire to destroy Jewish and Slavic people didn't mean that they were going to be nice to German people. It meant that German people were a tool of megalomaniac power. So I think the same thing applies here, that as you see, Israel is a great example. Its pretenses are washing away at the moment, and the fascism is rising to the surface. And the people of Israel will become just tools for a fascistic regime.
Just about coming to time, Tamim, I know you've got to shoot off as well. But I did want to give you the chance, Tamim, just to say any final words before we tap out.
We covered everything that I wanted to talk about. Obviously, the biggest ones were the use of starvation as a weapon and the recent accident, attacks, Shifa Hospital. Just wanted to add to the Al-Shifa, the assault on Al-Shifa Hospital. This is just one hospital, and in parallel to that, Israel has been attacking other hospitals. It has been attacking medics as well. So it can be seen as part of the overall attack on the healthcare in Israel, in Gaza, and just making life not possible at all, because without health system, you cannot sustain a population, you cannot sustain a life. So it's part of that theme. Yeah, I think that covered everything that I really wanted to talk about tonight.
Fantastic. And if people are wanting to organize, where should they look?
I guess they just keep looking at social media for their local Palestinian solidarity groups. There are groups in each and every city or major, you know, area in New Zealand. So I think, yeah, just keep an eye on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, and join the protests and actions within where you live.
So if I can just say one thing, I just want to mahi to Tamim and acknowledge his leadership. Our media has failed us. Our commentators, our scholars have failed us. So our Palestinian whānau and their voices have really saved us, have educated us, have radicalized us. I don't know where I'd be if it wasn't for Tamim and his Twitter account. So if anyone wants to know how to organize and how to receive an incisive and focused analysis of what's happening, please follow Tamim on Twitter. It doesn't get better than that. But yeah, just thank you, Tamim, for everything that you're doing, and just know that we've got you. and that we're here for you.
Kia ora, Dylan.
All right. Share this around, as Dylan has just alluded to or said outright. Our media here aren't doing a particularly good job of covering this stuff. Certainly not having much long-form conversation about it, long-form articles, any nuance at all. So get the word out there. Go and follow all of them and watch what they have to say, because there's a lot more there than you're getting in establishment media. We'll be back on the weekend for current events. That's been another episode. We'll catch you then.
If artifices are then I'm living a pointless life, but I'm learning all your lessons. Fucking politics, there's no distinction. The words upon now is paid with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize a cost me ought to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day. This vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're on the road to hell.